2 years ago, I was very pessimistic about the future of Lavia Campesina because I was seeing all these difficulties to have a unity, and there were many conflicts and people would not agree. But I think that we've been able to overcome a lot of these differences just by talking, because we talk to each other, and also because all the members of organization Lavia Campesina care a lot for the unity of our movement.
We even think that with the blockade of the dispute settlement mechanism, we can say that it's a zombie WTO. It still appears alive, but it's almost dead already. As Lavia Campesina, we have written a kind of first draft of what would be a new trade system working for the people. And we are now looking for allies. Allies in organizations, civil society organizations, but also allies in governments. And we are thinking in particular about progressive governments of the southern countries who we think could or should be interested in this project.
As you can hear, this will be another episode in English, because for the second time I speak to Morgan Odie, farmer from Brittany in western France and the current coordinator of Via Campesina, the global alliance of small-scale farmers or peasants that the ABL is also part of. I asked Morgan for this interview because I find it striking how big and influential Via Campesina is on a global level, but how little people in Germany actually know about it. So I asked Morgan about her work, what she has done since our last conversation in September, and especially about Via Campesina's most recent campaign on free trade. In the first half of the conversation, Morgan and I talked about Via Campesina as a peace movement, how they deal with the wars in Ukraine and Palestine, in Sudan and Congo, and with militant gangs in Mali and Haiti. We talked about the important work on peasant feminism that comes from the work done by the member organizations in Latin America, and that is slowly reaching the other member organizations. And we talked about the value of international exchange more generally. In the second half of the conversation, we move to a topic that is currently close to my heart, free trade and food sovereignty. These are the issues why Via Campesina was created in the first place. Peasants worldwide realized in the 90s that they need to ally on a global scale because free trade is putting them into competition with each other and destroying peasant existences everywhere. Today, Via Campesina is kind of rediscovering its founding issues and is launching a long-term campaign on replacing the World Trade Organization. This is a long conversation, but if you have time, I recommend to listen from the beginning to the end. But this time I also added chapters, so you can just jump to the part that is most interesting to you. Also, as a small disclaimer, I sat with Morgan in the garden together with Anastasia, a colleague of mine, so don't be surprised about the third person in the room and the occasional background noise. I hope I didn't get it wrong, but you are at the moment still coordinator of Lavia Campesina, right?
Yep.
What does that mean?
So I'm the general coordinator of Lavia Campesina. It means that I am a member of the International Coordinating Committee of the Campesina. We are 30 people. 3 per regions. There are 10 regions in Via Campesina. Europe is one region. And in each region, there is one man, one woman, and one young person below 35, man or woman or non-binary. We are representing the peasants' organization in our region. And we are making the everyday decisions of Lavia Campesina, this ICC. But also, there is an office of Lavia Campesina. And the place where the office is not always in the same place. Because also we believe that depending on where it is, it gives the opportunity to a region to have a little bit more influence and maybe know more about what is Lavia Campesina. So first it was in Central America, in Honduras. Then it was in Indonesia, Jakarta. Then it was in Africa, in Zimbabwe, Harare. And now it's the turn for Europe to have it.
It's so, there since a year or something like this now?
Since 2021. So
21.
a few years already. And so we have the office in Europe up to the next conference. So 27 or 28. And the regions where the office is has the mandate of the general coordination and names the person who is the general coordinator of Flavia Campesina. Being the general coordinator, it doesn't mean any, I can't make any decision on my own about Via Campesina. This is very good like this. All the decisions are collective with all the members of the ICC. But still it's in a way an honorific position, but also a responsibility to ensure that the movements work, that we maintain the unity and that we try to move forward, and in particular to have successful conferences where we define our priorities and that once we have our plan of action, that we implement our plan of action. So yeah, this is more or less what it is about. And it's also something collective in the sense that I am the general coordinator, but the European coordination Via Campesina is responsible for the general coordination of Flavia Campesina during this period. So it's also a collective responsibility of all the European peasants' organizations, member of Flavia Campesina, to ensure that the movement is doing well.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, last time we talked in September, that's 9 months ago, I actually didn't know that the office of the coordinating office was in Europe already for 2 years by then, because I had the feeling that this was quite an early stage still. So that's 9 months ago. What happened since then?
Wow, so since then we had the 8th International Conference of Flavia Campesina in Bogota. So normally we have these international conferences of Flavia Campesina every 4 years, but because of the pandemic of COVID, it was not possible to... Normally it should have been... The last one was in 2017, so normally it should have been in 2021, but, well, it was not possible. So we had to postpone it. And so we had the 8th International Conference of Flavia Campesina in Colombia in December. And that's a very important moment for the movement. And even more because it was 7 years without having it. And that's the moment when we have delegates from all the member organizations from all over the world joining together to analyze the situation in the world and to define the plan of action of Flavia Campesina for the upcoming years. So it's a very important moment for Flavia Campesina. We had 500 delegates from all over the world gathering during... So first we had the youth assembly, we had a woman assembly, we had a meeting of men against patriarchy, we had a diversity articulation assembly, and after that we had the conference itself with everybody. So all in all, I think it was 5 or 6 days of conferences, and I must say that it was very stressful for me and the organization and everything, but it was very successful. And also it was a relief because it was a moment of strong unity in the movement where we could really feel that this unity in diversity, that we are an extremely diverse movement of diverse in the geography, diverse for the age, in terms of gender, in terms of culture, even of ideology. But besides that, or thanks to that, we are extremely united.
How can there be such a strong unity if there's the war in Ukraine that is putting a lot of pressure because they are communist countries and they are countries that experienced the Russian or UdSSR occupation? There's the war in Palestine against Palestine. There's so much nationalism going on in the world. How can there be such a strong unity? I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, actually, you know, if we would have done this interview 2 years ago, I was very pessimistic about the future of Flavia Campesina because I was seeing all these difficulties to have unity, and there were many conflicts and people would not agree. But I think that we've been able to overcome a lot of these differences just by talking, because we talk to each other, and also because All the members organization La Via Campesina care a lot for the unity of our movement. So I think most of the organizations really are doing everything to maintain the unity, and it means listening to the others and trying to find a consensus. And I think in particular on the war in Ukraine, coming from very different backgrounds, but the common ground is that there are peasants in Ukraine and they are suffering of the war. And whatever we think of Zelensky or NATO or the geopolitics, we should support the Ukrainian peasants, the people. So it's to take, to take position in favor of the people and of the peasants and rural workers, and to see the situation in their eyes. And once we do this, even if in La Via Campesina, some organizations and people in the organizations would be very much pro-Ukrainian and some others would feel much closer from Russia. But at least we have this unity based on the fact that Russian peasants also should be respected and that we should take care of them, and that we should also consider the suffering that this war creates for Ukrainian peasants. And I think that this is an important unity to recognize this, that besides the geopolitics or the conflicts, we should be on the sides of the people.
Every person is a person, every peasant is a peasant.
Exactly. Every person is a person, and I think that we made a lot of progress in this, and also in trying to understand the need for Via Campesina as a movement to be a movement for peace. And we discussed a lot the issue of militarization, of wars, and also, because it's not only the war in Ukraine and the war in Palestine. There are so many other places where there are wars. Like right now, the situation in Sudan is terrible, terrible. The peasants there are being displaced, and almost no media is talking about this. The situation in Kivu, in Congo, it's very difficult. It's been a very, very long time, it's a terrible situation. And the peasants are the main victims of the war, which is very much linked to extractivism and very much imperialist also, a neo-colonial way of trying to grab the resources of these territories. And so I think we understood collectively that it was a priority for La Via Campesina to work on these issues. Another example is in Western Africa, there are these armed groups which are making the life of the peasants and the pastoralists very complicated.
Like in what countries and what territories?
Like in Mali, in Niger, these groups which most of them are called jihadist groups and take the identity of religion. But actually for our members' organizations in these countries, they are just gangs taking advantage of religious ideology to just gain power and steal the wealth of the peasants. And so it was very interesting to listen to to what they were saying, and they say that the peasants want to create peace and want to demilitarize these gangs. And what does it mean? It's complex. For example, for Mali, because of the colonial history, France would never let Mali create an army. And so when these gangs, after the war in Libya, where also France and the US participated in throwing away Gaddafi, was certainly not a very nice guy, but he was keeping the region very stable. And so after he was assassinated, Libya became very unstable and it completely destabilized Western Africa. And the armed groups were uncontrolled and would start to take the control of the Malian territory. And after then, so at that moment, where these groups were taking the power in Mali, France said, okay, we will come and save you. And so France sent the army, the French army there. And at that moment, Malian people and the peasants' organization were didn't know what to think so much about that. Some people were critical about it. Some people said, yeah, we need the French army to come and stop these armed groups, which are jihadist. But what they say is that it was very convenient for France to use this situation.
To have a foot in the country.
And also that they could do this because there is no Malian army.
Right.
Because France never allowed Mali to develop its army. And so, like 2 years ago, the French army was really also doing a lot of creating a lot of problems in the villages, killing people, and so the people got really fed up with the French army and say, okay, now we don't want the French army anymore. And there was this coup, and they defend the right that they have a Malian army controlled by the Malian people, like the sovereignty. So all these issues, just to say that there is complexity in it, but it's very much connected to colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialist policy. And if we talk, for example, of Haiti, it's a very similar situation. Like in the 90s, there was this leftist president, Aristide, who was elected and tried to change some things, but then he was kind of kidnapped, taken to the US, and when he was brought back to Haiti, it was under the condition that the Haitian army should be dismantled, which was done. And now in Haiti, you have these gangs who are terrorizing the people, and Haiti has no army to stop them. And so after 10 foreign military interventions to Haiti, which were disasters, they are now sending the Kenyan army to Haiti. They pretend that it is to fight against the gangs. But actually what the Haitian people want, they want no foreign intervention. They just want the Haitian people to dismantle these armed groups which are terrorizing the people and have a national army and a police which is able to control these things. So how we built on this to ensure that we get away from neocolonialism, from imperialism, and that the people can live peacefully and decide about how they want to live.
Is there a red thread? What it means then to be a peace movement?
It's very new. It's very new, but we want to work on it. And for example, I think one work that we could do would be to try to start discussions, exchanges between peasants' organizations on how peasants' movement in the last decades have been contributing to peace processes. And a very interesting example is the Colombian peasant movement, because they have been contributing very strongly to the peace agreement, which was signed. And now the first article of the first chapter of the peace agreement in Colombia is about integral agrarian justice, because very often wars and conflicts are linked to land grabbing or kind of exploitation of the farm workers, or so there are strong connections between agrarian injustices and the wars. So if we want to build a real peace, we need to build justice. And for this, the peasants' movement, most of the time, they have a key role. And even in Europe, if we think of the war in the Basque country, the member organization of Flavia Campesina in the Basque country has played a key role in trying to build the peace. Same thing for our member, not really our member organization, but peasants' movements in Ireland. They do play an important role in building peace and justice. But of course, it's not only about building peace, because, and I think on this, the Palestinians are right. They are saying, yeah, but if we have peace but we have no justice, then we will always have wars. Because if the peace is a peace against the people, where we we can't have our territory and where our land continue to be grabbed, even if the situation appear to be peaceful, but actually it's a ground for wars. So when we talk of peace, we always need to talk about peace and justice, how we build justice.
Yeah, not just a freezing of conflicts.
Not just an imperialist peace, yeah. Which is most of the time the case, where it's the peace of the winner and the losers of the war are, well, just helpless and preparing for the next attack. That's not what we want to build. We want to build justice so that people, yeah, feel that there is no need anymore to struggle with weapons.
I think I want to jump to another type of war, violence, type of injustice that struck me when you talked about Bogota. You said there was also a meeting of men against patriarchy in the winter when we had the meeting of the ABL. We, as some young male farmers, wanted to have a reflective moment also of men thinking about feminism and, yeah, our role as men and so on. And we were two people, and this was the two people who organized the event. Mm-hmm. So no one really showed up. And it's interesting for me that you, on an international conference, had a separate meeting where men actually met up. Do you know anything about how this worked? I guess you weren't there.
No, I wasn't there. But what I know is that during a period in La Via Campesina, so there was the women assembly. And during the women assembly, the men were drinking beers and not working about this issue. And we thought that it was important that also the men would start to think and work about how they could contribute to dismantling patriarchy. And so this is the idea about this. It's not easy, because in the beginning also, among the women, we thought, okay, we don't want to create a space for men to strengthen their power. So it's the reason why the name of the meeting is Men Against Patriarchy. It's not a men assembly. It's a meeting of men against patriarchy. The goal of the meeting is to dismantle patriarchy. I think it's important to say this really very, very clearly. And of course, we make it, it's not an obligation, but we strongly encourage all men to participate to it. And I think that what I hear is that they also find an interest on it, on how these patriarchal patterns creates suffering for so many men, that you need to be strong and you need to not show your feelings, and all those things that also make life not so easy for many men. So also the idea is that also, of course, dismantling patriarchy is about dismantling privileges of men, but also it can be actually a process which is where men can find a way to live better and yeah, have a better, nicer life actually outside of domination. So
do you know how this meeting looked like? What they did? Did they have input there, a speaker, or was it facilitated by someone?
What is very clear is that it's not a meeting without women, in the sense that in order to facilitate the discussions on patriarchy, we need to have women also explaining to men what is patriarchy about and what women are living because of this domination, because very often it's invisible for men. If you are a man, you don't know what it is to be dominated by men. So it's important that women participate in this space, and also that it's a process of making these dominations visible, and that people understand about what it is. Not for the men to feel guilty. It's not a question of feeling guilty. It's a question of dismantling these domination patterns. And so, yeah, I think it's a process. And it's a process which is also similar to anti-racist process. I think, I am a white person. I'm not necessarily aware of
of when I talk or how I behave, that it creates domination. But it does. So in order to get out of that, we need to create methodology to make this domination visible so that we are able to get out of it without necessarily feeling guilty about it, but thinking that we will all have a better life if we go out of this domination.
Can you tell us a little bit more about why unmantling patriarchy is so important for the peasant movement?
I think it's important as a social movement aiming at social justice, equality, and a better world. And as a peasant movement, these are also our goals. But maybe in particular in peasants' movements, I think in particular in Europe, when you think of a peasant, you think of a man. And that's so wrong, because actually women are peasants, and very often I would say even more peasants than men, in the sense that in how the economic is organized, the economical life, very often in a farm the men would take care of the commercial part of the farm. So the men would grow the crops to be sold, and very often the women would take care of producing the food for the family and the community, the non-commercial part of the activity on the farm, which is much more like peasant way of producing. And a lot of the activities of which are very important for Via Campesina, like reproducing the seeds, are mainly done by women. So also making this task more visible, giving more importance to all those tasks, it's part of popular and peasant feminism. And of course, it's also about encouraging men to enter more in this task. I think in a better world, the tasks linked to taking care of the children, the elderly, taking care of the earth, taking care of the animals, it's key for the better world. And it's mainly tasks that women have been doing. And we want more people to take care of the others and of the earth. So in that sense, I think popular peasant feminism is very important for La Via Campesina.
And do you know if this is also happening in the member organizations? Because a feeling that I have is that it's always very special people that engage really with La Via Campesina and not just with ABL, with Confederación Paisan, like go to these international meetings and maybe speak English or Spanish or French well enough and so on. Do you know if these kinds of meetings, that like the one that you mentioned, Men Against Patriarchy, is this also coming back to the member organizations?
It's very slow and it does not happen everywhere, but it does have an impact. And for example, my organization is really not a very feminist organization. It has very patriarchal patterns, Confederation Paysanne, and I think we are quite late and not very much advanced in all those things. For example, the first woman spokesperson is the one that we have right now. Before that, in 30 years of the life of Confederation Paysanne, the spokespersons were always men, to tell you how bad it is. I discovered, last year, for the first time, there was a woman meeting, but there was a woman meeting in Conf, and the meeting was about peasant popular feminism, and really taking a lot of the ideas and that have been developed in La Via Campesina, mainly by the members organization in Latin America. So I think all these ideas have been developed in Latin America maybe 8 or 9 years ago. So it took a long time. But suddenly there were 100 peasant women of Confederation Paysanne discussing all this and feeling very much inspired about this and saying that, okay, we will defend now peasant popular feminism. And I find it amazing. And I think it's often the case that ideas circulate a lot within La Via Campesina. If we think of, for example, public stocks, it's been a very important topic for the Indian peasant organization for a long time.
So public stocks are like staatlich organisierte Lebensmittellagerhallen.
And it was a key topic of the farmers, Indian farmers protest in 2021, 2022. And I think that I discovered that at this moment. And I got aware that this is so important to have this kind of public stocks, because if the stocks are done by the corporations and the big companies, then they create speculation out of it against the peasants and against the consumers. And I think it was a completely new idea. And now in Europe, not all our members organizations, but a lot at least, we are talking about these stocks. And now I think even we have a shift that in the European Union institutions, the issue of public stock is an issue. And this is thanks to our Indian comrades. Mm-hmm. So I think that these ideas are circulating much more than what we think. Sometimes we don't know where the ideas come from, but very often they will have a link with international discussions, because we learn so much when we discuss with peasants or farm workers from another part of the world, and we have new ideas and we get inspired and why don't we do this also in my country? It's such a great idea.
I just read that in the 70s when the ABL was created, it was called differently then. They were just a bunch of men, farmers, and they went in the 70s over to France and were so inspired by your kind of organization of farmers as workers that they kind of came back to this German setting where protest was not so known, and then started to do this here as well, and they created so much attention. Everyone's like, oh, the farmers are protesting and doing blockades and so on, and something completely new. I think this is also a good example for this.
Yeah, and I think in long-term histories, this is how things work, that ideas circulate a lot at a very long distance, and we get inspired, and most of the social innovations is linked to the capacities that we have to connect with each other and discuss and debate and exchange about different realities. So I think that this is really... I think that we underestimate the importance that it has on our national organization, the fact that we are members of Via Campesina. It has a huge influence on so many things that we do. But most of the time, and I think it's quite sad to say, but most of the farmers who are members of our organizations have no idea that this reality is so influential. So I'm happy to do this this interview right now, because it's also an opportunity to exchange about this.
You talked already about stocks, and I think let's slowly get also to the topic that I mainly wanted to talk about. There's a big new issue that Via Campesina is picking up, which is a reform of the free trade system, which is a big topic, and we'll get deeper into this in a bit, but maybe you can just share a little bit how this topic came about, why you're picking this up again, because it's historically the big issue why La Via Campesina was created.
Yes, exactly. In the 90s, the peasants' organizations from Central America, South America, Canada, India, and Europe came together because all were very much worried about the impact that would have the creation of the World Trade Organization and the integration of agriculture within the free trade system and the globalization of the economy. And so this is really part of the identity of how La Via Campesina was born. And then, of course, the big mobilizations against WTO in Seattle, in Cancun, in Hong Kong. It's almost part of the mythology of Via Campesina, I think. But then, of course, the demand for food sovereignty is very much related to that as well. Because food sovereignty came as a response to food security. Most of the
governments would argue that food security would be achieved through free trade. Basically, that through comparative advantages, we would be able to... Comparative, it's the fact that, for example, it might be cheaper to produce wheat in France than in Morocco. And so that because it is cheaper to produce wheat in France than in Morocco, Morocco should stop producing wheat and instead produce only tomato, because it's cheaper to produce tomato in Morocco than in France. And so Morocco should specialize in tomatoes and France should specialize in wheat, and we should exchange with each other because the cheapest products. And if it is cheaper, then the poor people will have access to cheaper commodity and will be less poor.
Sounds logical.
Sounds logical. But the only problem with this is that if you make food cheaper, it means that you will make the food producers poorer. And the food producers are already the people who are hungry. So if you are making it more difficult for peasants to make a living, you are increasing hunger. So, and this is what happened after, after the 80s and the 90s, the big wave of neoliberalism, the hunger was not reduced. The hunger, especially among rural people, increased because it was more difficult to make a living out of farming. So all the critique of Flavia Campesina against this ideology was about the fact that we should allow each people to decide about its own food and agricultural system, and also that we should put the small-scale food producers at the center of the decision-making about how these food systems work.
And why aren't the people now able to create their own laws? I mean, just because there was a meeting of the World Trade Organization, or the World Trade Organization was created, why does this not allow people to give themselves their rules?
Because in the rules of the World Trade Organization, it's a lot about the fact that governments are very much restricted about the kind of public policies that they can create and implement in order to regulate agricultural and food markets.
Can you give an example?
On the food stocks, for example. The WTO creates rules that restrict a lot the rights of the countries and the governments to develop public food stocks. And food stocks are extremely important because a key aspect for small-scale food producers in order to be able to make a living is prices. If the prices are way below your cost of production, you don't make a living anymore. And prices are always a political construction. It's a construction linked to the relation of power between different actors in the economy, in the politics as well. Prices are political completely. But the neoliberal economy pretends that prices are the result of the market, the free hand of the market. And so states should not intervene in the setting of prices. And so that all policies trying to control the level of the prices should be dismantled. And public stocks, one of the goals of public stocks is to have an impact on the prices. So I will try to give an example. If you have prices which are increasing and that it's starting to be dangerous, if you have public stocks, you can sell them on the market and it will give more offer and it will stabilize the prices. It will stop the increase of the prices. On the contrary, if you have prices which are going down and down and down, which is becoming dangerous for the small-scale food producers because their incomes are going down, if the public stocks you are buying out of the market, you are making the prices, stabilizing the prices and making them increase again. So it's a way to, the fact to have public stocks, it stabilizes the prices.
This sounds, when you explain this now, totally logical. Why doesn't this exist? Or maybe it exists in India now, but mostly doesn't exist.
Well, it's more complicated because it's power relations. When you privatize stocks, because stocks always exist. There are stocks right now in Germany, in France. There are stocks, but the stocks are private. How private stocks work is that when the prices are going up, a private company will think, I do have stocks. The prices are going up. I might want to wait a little bit before I sell my stocks in order to increase my profits. So they will have a tendency to not sell, put on the market their stocks, and wait for increasing the prices. On the contrary, when the prices are going down, they will think, I might wait a few more weeks before I buy this food or this commodity, agricultural commodity, to the farmers, because the prices might continue to go down. So private actors will have a tendency to manage the stocks in a way that creates more instability in the prices. Exactly the contrary from what public stocks can be used to stabilize the prices. Is it clear what I say?
Yeah, I think so. And is it a theory, or do we know that this, for example, when the war started against Ukraine, there was too little grain and there was too little maize, for example. Do we know that this kind of behavior happened
very,
in Europe?
For example, it's very clear that when the war started in Ukraine, that there was a huge speculation on grains. There was a kind of people felt the fear, and the fear was very much mediatic, and the fear would create an increase in the prices even if the harvest had been very good. So we know that actually there was no problem of food supply. There was enough food for everybody. But because of this atmosphere of fear, the prices would go really completely crazy, and this created hunger. Not a shortage of food, but the fact that there was speculation and prices going completely crazy, so poor people who didn't have money were not able anymore to buy. So who benefits out of it? It's very clear. The people who are in Cargill or in Burge, in these big grain companies, or the people...
Like the ABCD.
Yeah, the ABCD.
Trading companies.
Yeah. And also the people, the traders or the people in the financial sector, they have a huge interest in maintaining the stocks private because it's their business. They are making huge money out of speculation.
And in that context, it's maybe interesting fact that I learned a year ago is that when the WTO was created, that the negotiator for the US was actually an executive of Cargill, exactly one of these companies. So just to understand this right, that public stocks are not allowed, that's part of the trade order that we have right now? Or what does it have to do exactly with trade?
Yeah, it's not that they are not allowed, it's that they are really very strongly restricted. So, and a lot of countries have problems to develop their food stocks because it's strongly restricted. The WTO completely changed the European agricultural system. And I think too few people are aware about that. That up to the late 80s, early 90s, in the EU, the internal prices were quite high. We had quite high minimum support prices. And in order to export and be competitive on international market, the EU would give export subsidies. But then this was highly criticized, with very good reasons, by the southern countries, including the countries like Brazil, which were saying, okay, I am also exporting, but I can't give export subsidies, so you're creating a situation which is very unfair and a distortion in the international markets. Fair enough. it's a reality. So the system that the US and the EU negotiated with each other, because they negotiated with each other, it's called the Blair House Agreement, just after the fall of the Soviet Union, in a moment of the geopolitics where the West was extremely strong and the rest of the world very weak in comparison, with no counterpower. And what they decided to do was to change the system. Instead of having high internal prices and to give export subsidies, they decided to give subsidies, direct payments to the farmers, and to lower the prices.
So that's like the common agriculture policy, the gemeinsame Agrarpolitik that we have right now, these subsidies.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So before 92, the CAP was about market regulation, the CMO, Common Market Organizations, for every product. After that, most of the roles from the CMOs were dismantled. So you still have the name, a few roles, but it was really dismantled. And what was created was a whole system of direct payments. And you would see that the prices of most of the agricultural commodities did go down, and very often did go below the cost of productions.
Because farmers didn't have to live from the product prices anymore, but could live from the subsidies, and this way could sell their products for less than they actually cost.
Well, the farmers receiving subsidies could do this. Of course, the majority of the farmers who did not receive subsidies or did receive very, very little subsidies were very strongly affected by the fact that prices would go down. So most of the small-scale farmers in Europe are also victims of this system, because they don't get the subsidies, but they do get the very low prices. But you have a category of either big or middle-sized farmers who are getting the subsidies and who are able to sell their products at a price below the cost of production, or at least, if you look at so many middle-sized or even big farmers, if you take away the subsidies, their result is negative. So without subsidies, their system is no way sustainable. And that was the goal. And who are the big winners of this? The retailing sector and the agro industry, because they were able to buy agricultural products below the cost of productions, but they continued to sell it as expensive. So if you look at the margins of big companies like Danone, Nestlé, in the 90s, they were so happy. Their margins increased a lot because they were buying cheap and continuing to sell expensive to the consumers. Because they were, in the end, now it's 50 billions of CAP payment every year. We pretend that it goes to the farmers, but no, in the end, it goes to the retailing sector and to the agro industry, because thanks to these subsidies, they are able to buy below the cost of production. And thanks to this, the system is very, of the farm bill and the system of CAP is very similar, or at least was very similar.
Farm bill is the policy in the US.
Yes. Yeah. And thanks to this, the European grain can be competitive on international markets, and it does not need, or does not need so much, export subsidies anymore. And the WTO pretends that direct payments are part of the green box and that it does not distort the market. It's a big joke. It's aimed at distorting the market. But the WTO pretends that it's okay, because the WTO rules have been written by the EU and US people and corporations.
So just to understand this right, the WTO was created in the early 90s. And part of the WTO was that certain national legislations need to be changed, and the US and the EU managed to have the subsidies as they are now being allowed in the green box. But yeah, actually, you think they are distorting the free trade, yes, that we have.
So the direct payments are in the green box. It's okay. You can give as much as you want. But for example, if you want to have minimum support prices, this is considered in the red box. So for example, even if you don't give subsidies, but you create mechanism of supply management that ensure that the prices paid to the farmers are higher than the prices on international market, it will be considered a subsidy.
there is no money given as a subsidy, but by the WTO, it will be part of the red box, considered as support.
Even so there you can see how international trade, how it is organized today, is taking away the freedom for government to regulate their own markets.
Exactly. And it's been done in a way that was extremely unfair for southern countries, because southern countries' support to their farmers was really strongly restricted. They had to open their markets. But the US and the EU could develop a policy making them in a position to be extremely competitive and supporting extremely strongly their big farmers. So this is the reason why now what we are building in Via Campesina is an alliance of the peasants and small-scale farmers from the north and the south. Because as European farmers, we are also cheated by this system. Because me, I have a farm of 1.3 hectare, I produce vegetables, I don't receive anything from CAP, zero. But I am hurt by the fact that vegetables in France are sold extremely cheap because the big players, they receive tens of thousands of euro every year of SCAP payment and sometimes hundreds of thousands of euro. So they also compete with me in a very unfair way because they receive the subsidies and I don't receive anything. And I am in a very similar position like the peasants in Mali who also have to compete with these products from European big farmers who are benefiting from subsidies. So the question, we are not against subsidies, but we are against subsidies that are being used as a way to be competitive on international markets against small-scale food producers.
So I think what is kind of new for me to learn here is that this way how the Gemeinsame Agrarpolitik, the CAP, is organized is very much linked to international trade. But I think I want to focus a bit more again on first on the history of what did La Via Campesina then do. We had the 90s, we had the creation of the WTO, we had all these changes of the laws, and La Via Campesina organized and tried to create an alternative with the food sovereignty concept. So what happened since the 90s?
So the position of Via Campesina is we want to dismantle the WTO. So we don't want to reform the WTO because we don't think that it's possible to make the WTO an institution in favor of the people. So during a long time, our strategy was to dismantle the WTO. But the problem is that we have this agreement on agriculture of the WTO, which is there and which is making our life very bad. So we have decided a few years ago that in order to go out of this situation, we need to build an alternative. We need to build a new trade framework based on food sovereignty, solidarity, internationalism. And also because we became aware that if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it. The governments are not going to do it. The NGOs are not going to do it. So we need to do it ourselves. And also with the process of the UN declarations on the rights of peasants and other people working in rural area, we discovered that it was possible, actually, for us as a peasant movement to work with the UN and to have the UN General Assembly passing a resolution to create a new legal tool. So now that we have done this for peasants' rights, we know that it's possible and we will try to do the same for trade. Of course, we know that it will be complicated. For the UN Declaration on Peasants' Rights, it took us 18 years.
18.
Yes. So it's long processes, and we know that for trade it's even more complicated. So we don't think that next year we will have a new trade framework based on food sovereignty. But we hope that through hard work, within 20 years, we can change this.
It's extremely audacious, extremely Größenwahnsinn, I think. Like, how do you think it's possible? Like, the World Trade Organization, the whole trade system that we have now, it was created from by governments kind of after the Second World War, after the Cold War. There was a lot of opportunity, and now you think, or we think, that as peasant organizations we can change this?
Well, because the system is really... it's really in a bad position now, the WTO. even since Trump, the system for dispute settlement is completely blocked because Trump decided to not send any judge in the system anymore. So what was creating really the power of WTO, which was this dispute settlement, which was very powerful, it doesn't work anymore. And the WTO has been blocked for now more than 20 years because countries' governments do not agree with each other on any reform of the agreement on agriculture. So WTO is already in a big crisis. We even think that with the blockade of the dispute settlement mechanism, we can say that it's a zombie WTO. It still appears alive, but it's almost dead already. And we think that it's really, with also the geopolitical situations, many countries do not accept anymore the domination of the world by the US. And we see that there is slowly a power shift in the world with some, it has of course some positive sides and also some negative sides. Some of the wars that we see right now are linked to this geopolitical shift. But in any case, we see that this could also be perhaps an opportunity to change the trade system. And we hope in particular that countries in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, they can at one moment think, okay, actually this World Trade Organization system works against us. Why don't we build a new trade system that would really work in particular for the southern countries? And so as La Via Campesina, we have written a kind of first draft of what would be a new trade system working for the people. And we are now looking for allies in organizations, civil society organizations, but also allies in governments. And we are thinking in particular about progressive governments of the southern countries who we think could or should be interested in this project.
Before you tell about how this draft looks like, do you think, you mentioned that the office of the World Trade Organization, that you actually talk to them. Do you think that's also because they feel that they are a zombie organization?
Actually, we didn't talk to them, but they wanted to invite us to a discussion. So I received an email, it was 1.5 years ago, of someone from the WTO asking for a meeting with La Via Campesina. It is something that they had not done. The previous time that they had done this was in 2005, during the Hong Kong negotiations, where WTO was in a terrible situation. So we know that when they contact us, they are in a bad situation, basically. And we decided to refuse to talk with them because obviously they are trying to reform the WTO to save the WTO. And for us, we see no interest in saving the WTO. We want the WTO to get down and to build something else. So we decided to refuse to talk with them and instead to work with other institutions, because we are not against institutions. We are, for example, for us, the UN multilateral system is something important. It has a lot of flaws, a lot of problems, but it's important. It's important, just like it's important to have a space where peasants from different countries talk together. We believe that it's important to have spaces where diplomats from all the countries can discuss with each other to try to avoid wars. It does not always work, but at least when there are spaces, there is an opportunity that people talk to each other and try to understand each other. So we are in favor of the United Nations system as such. But of course, we think that part of the system, like the Security Council, where five countries have a veto right, it's very unfair. Why does France has a right for veto and not Germany? Why the US has a right for veto and not Nigeria? It's very unfair. So for us, the General Assembly of the United Nations is legitimate, but not the Security Council. So We believe, for example, that there is another UN institution which is very interesting, which is the UN Conference for Trade and Development, UNCTAD. It's an institution that has been created by mainly southern countries after the independences in order to...
Verschuldung.
Yeah, yeah, in order to create a new fair trade system that would work for the southern countries and for the people. We agree with this vision. We find it very inspiring. And we just think that up to now they have completely failed. But we find it interesting to talk to this institution and to see how we could work with them to renew the very strong inspiration that they had in the 60s and 70s and make it work and replace the WTO.
So then let's trace this back. You got this email from the WTO. You refused to talk to them. And now there's this process in Via Campesina to find a new trade system. How did this look like? Like, can you explain a little bit how these months and years look like since then?
So we have made meetings with with people in our members organizations interested into this into building a new trade systems. And I don't know how meetings we have had, maybe some 10 or 12 meetings to try to think about what should be the articles in a new trade system. And so we've wrote the first draft, we discussed it, we've wrote a new draft, we discussed it. Each time we need to translate everything, so it takes a long time. And now we are in the moment where we have it's not a final draft, because I think it's never going to be a final draft, but we have a draft where we feel confident enough to present it to, well, within our the network of Flavia Campesina, but also to allied organizations, and and so the document that we have, it has 5 chapters. The first chapter is about the right for all people and countries to food sovereignty. So it's basically saying that the countries and the people, they do have the right to decide about their agricultural policies. If they want to do stocks, they can do stocks. If they want to have minimum intervention prices, they can. If they want to have a standard saying that, I don't know, if in Germany, for example, you want to decide that that food is not allowed in Germany for a reason or another, you have the right to decide this.
Like GMOs.
Like GMOs, for example. GMOs. Exactly, exactly, exactly. So this is the big first chapter. And this is completely opposite of the WTO, which is putting so much restriction on what peoples and governments can do in terms of agricultural policies. The second chapter is on how we organize the trade, because we are in favor of trade. We think that exchanging is nice, and that just like exchanging ideas is very nice, it can be very nice to have the possibility to eat a mango for a special occasion. And I believe that also some people might be very happy to have a taste of Roquefort. So it's fine, there is no problem in trading. The problem in trading comes if the trading rules impede to have decision made about food sovereignty, but it's not a necessity. So once we establish that we have food sovereignty, then we can trade. How do we want this trade to be organized? First, we want no country to be excluded from trade. And right now it's not the case, because the US has decided that, for example, Cuba or Iran are not allowed to participate to international trade. Why should it be? How is it that the US can decide that a country is excluded from international trade? We find it very unfair. So for us, it's an important role that no country should be excluded. Then another thing is that we think that for many products, it's better to exchange at the more local level. So if it's possible to have exchanges between France or Germany, why should we trade with a country which is very, very far away? I mean, also in terms of greenhouse gas emission, it makes no sense. So we think it's better for Argentina to trade with Brazil and Uruguay than to trade with Europe, for example. Another thing is that we do believe that trade should not be in the hands of big corporations and speculation. And for this, there is a very interesting tool that was very much used in the 60s, 70s, 80s, which is the commodity agreements. It's two governments signing up a contract with the prices defined, saying, okay, I will export to your country that many millions of tons of that products at that price for the next 5 years. And this stabilizes, because if, for example, if in France we don't produce coffee, if tomorrow we would be completely excluded from having coffee, that would be terrible for me personally.
So it's the classic example of what people can't not consume.
So if we sign long-term contract with, I don't know, with Vietnam or with Kenya, any country, or Ethiopia producing great coffee, and we stabilize the prices, then it's a way to organize trade which can be really much stabilizing and getting rid of speculation. So it's a model that we believe that we should re-establish this kinds of, maybe not call it commodity agreements, but maybe food agreements or, yeah, this kind of thing. And we believe that UN organizations like FAO should help organizing this trade.
FAO.
That it is their role to organize it. And actually there is already and still a committee in FAO which could help do this, which used to be doing this. It is the Committee on Commodity Problems, CCP. And we believe that this space used to be the space where these commodity agreements were negotiated, and it could take on this task again, actually, instead of letting the stock option in Chicago or in Paris organize this trade.
Which are private trading places.
In the hands of big corporations with huge corruption and some actors which are not producing anything, but which are doing huge money just because they have the capacity to control how the financial system is working.
What else?
So is written there? That is the second big chapter. The third chapter is on the issue of prices and the currency, because the trade, international trade, right now, it's 90% of it is in dollar, and dollar is not the controlled by the UN. Dollar is the currency of the United States of America, with a specific country controlling it and deciding whether they would produce more dollar or less dollar and the value of the dollar. So it creates a big difference in power for the country who is controlling the currency of international trade.
Because, for example, when they want to buy something, they can just print it.
Exactly. So there is no problem for the US to have a huge deficit because they control the currency and they can create as much dollar as they want. But, for example, a country like Sri Lanka, if they want to buy something on international market, they need to get dollar. So they need to ensure that they sell enough things and get the dollar before they can buy things on international markets.
So they need to export to get dollar into their bank accounts so that they can buy something on the global marketplace.
Exactly. And then it's very much linked to the role of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Because what happens is that most of the countries, they would need dollar. So they would need to lend dollar.
Borrow.
So the IMF of the World Bank would come and say, okay, we will give you a, what do you call this?
Loan.
A loan. But the condition is that you should privatize this company, and you should change this pension law in your country. So in the end, it's not the people from Sri Lanka deciding anymore. It's the IMF and the World Bank.
So it's again an example how the trade influences
exactly.
The
and who
freedom.
Decides in the World Bank and the IMF? World Bank and IMF, they are not really part of the United Nations system. In the United Nations, it's one country, one voice. Well, besides this terrible Security Council. In IMF and World Bank, the one who decides are the one who are putting the money. So it's the rich country. overwhelmingly the US, but also European countries, have a lot of power in the IMF and the World Bank, while most of the African countries have no voice there. So it's again, it's a power game, where in the end, it's always the old colonial powers who are deciding. And we want to get rid of that. We want to have normal relations between France and Mali, equal relations. And we want to have equal relations between the US and Sri Lanka, not this kind of power relation when there is one power which can decide about everything and another power or another government which can decide about nothing and which is completely under the influence of the big power.
And then, so you have this third article that says you don't want to have everything managed in dollar, but how
but in other currencies.
Then?
Well, what we would like is we want diversification. So it could be possible to trade more in a vast diversity of currencies, in euro, in rand, in the currency of in pesos, in many currencies, so that if a country in its reserve it has no dollar but it has pesos, it's okay, they can participate to international trade. And also an interesting idea is that the currency could be not the currency of a national state but actually a commodity. It could be a kind of Brazil exports soy to France, and France exports wheat to Brazil, and on the accountability we say that it's okay and we don't need dollars in between. This kind of ideas, we can be very creative.
We can be creative, right?
Yeah, we can
ways.
Be creative. And currency, it's a human system. It's about politics. It's about power. So we should not consider that it's there and it can't be changed. It's a human institution. We are able to change it if we decide. The reason why we don't change it is that the powerful people who have the privilege, who are controlling the system, they don't want to change it. But actually, as people, as a majority of people, do we want this system or not? And if we consider that it's not in favor of the majority of the people and that it creates problems for the climate, it creates inequality, that it creates problems for the democracy, why don't we change this? So this is also about democracy. If we consider that a system is not working for the majority of the people, we should change it. And actually, in La Vega Campesina, we consider that the current trade system based on dollar is bad for the vast majority of the people, for 99% of the people. And so we should just change it and make it work for the people.
What's an article for?
So article 4, it's about, sorry, let me think. It's about a very important element. It's about natural disasters and wars. It might seem very strange in a trade system to put it, but it's really linked to the experience of peasants, that when you, in your country, you're facing a natural disaster, it's very sad to say this, but very often the help that you get from the other countries is another disaster for small-scale food producers. Because very often, after a natural disaster, the World Food Programme will send food to feed the people. Okay, it's probably needed to get food from other... But who is controlling the World Food Programme? It's also in the end very much of big corporations and big imperialist powers. So very often this food aid will be a way to destroy the local food system and to not let it be rebuilt.
Again, do you have an example?
Yeah, for example, so Haiti is a very good example. It has faced a huge earthquake. Yeah, that earthquake, and after that, a lot of food was received through the World Food Program for free in the beginning. So you receive a lot of food that comes for free, if you are Haitian, if you are an urban citizen in Port-au-Principe, if you get food for free, will you keep buying food to the peasants who is your neighbor? No, you will just take the food for free. So this kind of situation, even if the peasants continue to be able to produce food, they can make them bankrupt because they face the competition of this free food from the World Food Program. And so once the local agriculture is destroyed, what will happen is that suddenly it's not going to be free anymore, but you create a dependency, and suddenly Haiti is dependent on the imports of flour from the US, and you create a dependency. And also, when you are in a very difficult situation, you cannot really decide about the conditions. So very often the food aid is GMO. You are against GMO, but you face a big disaster. Your people are hungry, and as a government of a southern country in a difficult situation, you cannot say, "Oh, actually, I would prefer this flour to not be GMO."
Genetically modified organisms.
Yeah. You are not in a position. You are not in a position to negotiate this. So it's very often a way that new standards are imposed on your people that in other conditions you would never accept. And once it's there, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
So in Article 4 you say this should not happen and this should be organized in a different way.
What we say is that food should never be used as a weapon of war. So and that in particularly in the situations of war or situation of natural disasters, we should really ensure a strong participation of the peasants' organization in how the relief is organized. And as soon as possible, we should ensure that instead of having food aid, to have money to pay for the food produced by the local farmers, by the local fisherfolk, to ensure that they can rebuild their infrastructure and that you rebuild the local food system. And this is a much better way to help a country which is facing a disaster. And now that we are now in this big climate crisis, we will have more and more of these disasters. And the disasters are always moments of big social change, for the better or for the worse. And we believe that also that our members' organization should become much more prepared to deal with these disasters. Most of the time you cannot stop a disaster. But the day after a disaster, when we need to rebuild, this is when the big game starts. And you need to ensure that you are at the table of negotiation to ensure that the money will go for the small-scale food producers to rebuild and will not go to big Western NGOs that will impose a completely neocolonial way of rebuilding not linked to the interests of the people. There is a fascinating film about this done by an Haitian filmmaker, Raoul Peck. It's called Mortal Assistance. And it's about this situation in Haiti, where after this earthquake, there was this second disaster, which was this Mortal Assistance. All these NGOs, all the Western government went to Haiti, and suddenly Haitian people could not decide about anything in their countries anymore. And since now, I mean, the disaster in which Haiti is now, it's very much linked to this Mortal Assistance. So we should really ensure that the trade rules take that into account and ensure people's sovereignty in these moments of disaster.
Let's go to the last article.
The last article is about the commons. It's about the fact that most of the time trade agreements are also about investment. And investment are very much linked to land and water grabbing. So we want to ensure that in the trade system, that land, water, the seeds, territories in general can never be used as commodities or sold out to foreign investors, but that they should always be considered as commons where the local people should decide about how they are being used.
Which is also something that, for example, in Germany or in France, with water and land being bought up more and more, seems very directly relevant.
Exactly. And we really need this kind of roles. And of course, it's directly related to the need to have policies of agrarian reform and other policies to better distribute the land. And for example, I don't know if you remember the Cochabamba case about water. the water in Bolivia was privatized. And when Evo Morales arrived in power, he tried to change the rules and to make water a public good again. And he had to face huge legal procedures from the big Western corporations, which were considering themselves the owners of the Bolivian water. And so there was a big case, a legal case, where I don't know if finally Bolivia won or not, but it was a very famous case where the trade rules were against the Bolivian people's will to get back the control on water. And so this kind of examples show how important it is to have a trade system that ensures that water, land, territories are considered as common goods, where the people living in the territories have the right to decide about how these commons are being used.
Okay. Maybe to slowly come to an end, we have this, La Via Campesina now wrote this draft, and you have these five articles with this.
It's five chapters, right. I think it's 19 articles, yeah. Something like this.
What happens now? What's the next steps?
So the next steps, it's to make it known and understandable. In particular, we know that it's not enough to write it. It's if we want the people in our members' organizations to take it and use it, we need to make it into formats that are understandable by a lot of people. So now the communication team of La Via Campesina will work on making it beautiful with drawings so that everybody can understand what it is about. I think the next step will be to have it translated not only in English, Spanish and French, but also in many other languages like Germans, so that the members of ABL, for example, can read it, discuss it, and hopefully go and have meetings with the members of parliaments and say, oh, okay, have a look at this, and I want to discuss about this because we believe that we should change the trade system. And also what we want to do is that we are asking meetings with, for example, people in the UN conference on trade and development to see if they would be interested in working with us on these plans. We have asked to become observers in this Committee on Commodity Problems of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, because we want also to better understand if it's possible to do something in this space. So once again, it's really the beginning. It's going to take a long time. I know that a lot of people are very impatient, and I think it's normal, and I'm happy that people are impatient to work about that. It's going to be a long process. And I think it's a process also where everybody can take part to it to start discussing these plans, to start discussing of what have been the impact of not only WTO, but also bilateral free trade agreements on our daily life. I mean, if you look at it as farmers in France or in Germany, it has huge impact on the fact that we don't make a living, or we need to work so much to make a living just because we don't get prices connected to the real cost of production. In particular, we don't get prices that allow to have a fair income for farmers. So I think to start really building up discussions, public debates, debates with the society, debates with politicians on the issue of what is a fair price? How do we build new institutions to ensure that we have a fair price? How do we rebuild public policies in Europe based on market regulation so that we get these fair prices? And I think it's very connected to what happened with the farmers' protests last winter, because of course it was very much manipulated by the far right, but a lot of the people who went on the street because they are tired and angry to work so much for such a small income. So it's very much about prices. It's very much about dignity in my work. If I don't get a fair income and I'm not recognized in terms of income for my work, then I have some reasons to be angry. So I think that really now to use this momentum in our countries to say we want to talk about prices
and to think big, I
I guess that's what
and to think big. And also to be very clear that the EU, the European Union, is a big player in this game. It's the main region, it's the region with the main agro-industry. And the agro-industry is the biggest and most powerful industry in the European Union. So the work that we are doing in Europe, if we manage to change the relation of power, if we manage to convince people in the European Commission to change things, if we manage to change the trading and agricultural system in Europe, it will have huge impact in Africa. It will have huge impact in Latin America. And so it's and it will be good also for us. But so it's a big responsibility that we have in Europe to change our own system, which is bad for us as European small-scale farmers, but which is also so bad for the peasants and farmers in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. So I think instead of thinking, very often European people think, oh, how could we change the system in Ghana so that Ghana farmers make a better living? No, that's not the point. The point is in changing all European system, which creates so much inequality. And I think that it's an important task for us to do.
Sounds like a very concrete place where we can start. I think for now it's good. I think we have very clear to-dos in ABL and in Germany to discuss. And
in particular in Germany, I would say, because German is a very powerful actor in the European Union. So if you manage to create change in Germany, this can have a huge impact on the European Union.
All right. Thanks, Morgan.
Thank you.